This reflection was done by Ajahn Viradamo just before he left Abhayagiri in 2011. It's called Parting Words. It's hard for you to imagine how good this is for me. As you know, I've been in a different kind of semi-monastic situation for most of the past decade. This is my first outing from the Ottawa Valley for many, many years, and my first reconnection to this very special and very beautiful tradition. This morning I was sharing with Lumpur and others a dream I had last night. It was such a good dream, I've just got to do it again. It was around 3:30 in the morning, and I was sitting around with Sangha. A coffin came in through the door. The coffin was large, blue, and very regal. Then immediately after that, there was another coffin coming through. I didn't see the size or color of the coffin, but I noticed that one of the pallbearers was my mother. And I was so happy to see her because I haven't had a dream where I've actually seen her. So this is the first dream I've had. I was just so happy to see her. The coffin went up some stairs. I jumped up, followed it up the stairs. There were billowing sheets of cloth around my head. I got into a room and Mum was lying there. She was dying. I was just so happy to see her. I kissed her on the cheek and she said, "Take care of the tomatoes." And I woke up so happy. You know, one of those dreams you get rarely. It's just so right, so happy. So, what's with the tomatoes? What I wanted to reflect on today was stories. When my mum died, it was quite a difficult death, and I had a tremendous sense of despair. And I think when we have despair, we look for meaning. That's a common human trait, expression of our hearts. So I got to pondering stories. I was reading The Three Watchers of the Night of the Buddha, the Night of Enlightenment, thinking about stories. As you recall, the first watch of the night, the Buddha's basically seeing this cosmic autobiography spread over a vast, vast expanse of time. He sees his own story, and in the text it says, "But any pleasant feeling there arose in him, he didn't attach to." I was imagining that. Personally, I'd be appalled. Oh, another story, story after story after story. Where does it end? When does it end? The second watch of the night, he sees the energy which generates stories, which generates rebirth, which generates this endless becoming of birth, death, and so on. And in the third watch of the night, he figures out how to put an end to stories through the Four Noble Truths. We live in a kind of paradox, at least the way I see it. We live in stories. Our practice is in a family narrative. We're not just heaps of aggregates, and yet the ultimate teaching is that there are just the aggregates. So there's a kind of a paradox that goes on. Because your mum and my mum are different people. Your experience of a meditation is different from mine. Your conditioning from your child is from your childhood. Mine is from mine. We do live in stories. We do live in narratives. The other night, some of the monks were giving me massage and I was recounting some of my Ajahn Chah stories, and they'd heard them all. "How can you have heard them all? I haven't told you yet." Ajahn Pasanoy told them. Ajahn Jayasaro told them. So we do live in a narrative, don't we? And the point of our personal story this lifetime is to put an end to stories. The worldling wants to just make the best story they can, a happy story. So for the worldling, the story is the end. It's the point of life, is a good story. For us, a good story is the method. Ultimately, we talk about ultimate truth. We say this doesn't really belong to anyone. It's a combination of elements and so on. But we do have the Dhamma Vinaya, and Vinaya is the kind of story we live as samanas. That's part of the story. And the beauty of this bhikkhu life, samana life, and those that want to participate with us in this life, is that much of it is choreographed for us already. like this beautiful ceremony. I mean, it's so touching, it's so graceful, so gentle, soft, it's so devotional, lovely. And we've learnt that from a tradition that understands the nature of ritual in our stories, the nature of devotion, the nature of art as a devotional reflection. So it's interesting to look in your own consciousness and see, what kind of stories do you tell yourself? Are they stories which are uplifting, inspiring, or are they put-down stories? I could have a pathetic meditation where I was just squirming for a whole hour. I could paint the story, oh, you're pathetic, Viradamo. Or I could say, well, I didn't leave, I stayed with it. That's a story, isn't it? That's the sense of self. So we can use the sense of self in a way to create a beautiful story, live a beautiful story, the best we can. And then we have to let go of that, have to let go of the story, have to let go of the sense of self. But just to deny the sense of self like there is no story, well, there is a story. I do have a history, and I do have responsibilities. I'm the water monk or the IT monk. We have these kinds of definitions. I am senior. I am junior. I am a man. I am a woman. And they're the conventions that we live the story through. And so conventional reality is conventional, but it is important. It's very important, isn't it? I think Tan Ajahn Pasano exemplifies an understanding of how to create a beautiful story, to create a foundation in our lives, which then leads us to the possibility of putting down all stories. If you only have the story, then you're a worldling. But if you only have some kind of high teaching, then you have Krishnamurti. I studied Krishnamurti. I studied Krishnamurti, and he had a very, very high teaching. But how do you do it? How do you live this life of mindfulness? How do you cultivate? So we can, through thought, through imagination, through our readings, through our study, we can cultivate things like, I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma. That's a story, isn't it? Ultimately, we're looking for the karma that goes beyond karma, and there's the paradox. If I was only interested in good karma and good rebirth, then that would only be the first two watches of the night. What of the third watch of the night, where there's the freedom from the endless rebirths? And if you think about the Buddha's intention when he sets out, he sees the four Devadutas, old age, sickness, death, and a samana. His intention there is to realize the end of this whole cyclic birth and death drama that we're involved in. That's his intention. In the enlightenment, he sees this just goes on and on and on. And if you imagine that, if you look into our own minds, our own stories, how long will I perpetuate the stories of ignorance in my own mind? Stories of self-disparagement, or the stories of I am better than you, or I am lesser than you, you don't know what you're talking about, I don't know what I'm talking about, and all the rest of it that goes on. These are the stories of delusion. So how can you use thought and imagery and your own personal narrative to go beyond it? You can introduce language which is beautiful, grateful. So I am really grateful for being here. Now in my chanting, I only did the first part once. So I could say, I blew it. What's the point of that? What's the point of creating a negative story? And we do that to ourselves, don't we? Through our expectations of ourselves, through our high demands of what we should be. And I think people that come to this practice, we're really good people. We already have a high degree of aspiration and moral commitment. Perhaps one of our challenges in this life with these high ideals is to really monitor the storylines which are put-downs, which are self-disparaging, which are judgmental. Those are the habits of whatever. And to see that our aspiration, the fact that we come together in this way, that we live a moral life, that we give up a lot, we're given a lot, given an incredible amount, but we do give up a lot of freedom. We give up the possibility to move around, and we are obliged to live by a convention which is well tested and tried. And so we give up the freedom to do what we want to do, but we're given the freedom to watch the way things are. And this is part of the secret of a good monastic life. If I want the freedom to just do what I want to do all the time, then I tend to just follow my own preferences. As Ajahn Chah would say, that's practicing disaster. But if I see this is a structure that's given to me, and I give myself to that, and then I can watch the stories that come within that. I like it. I dislike it. I'm no good at it. I'm great at it. I'm not getting anywhere in my practice. Those are just stories. The grace of this life is to begin to live in a way which is very, very present, very, very mindful, and to abandon the stories of greed, hatred, and delusion. Just not to go there, not to go there anymore. The stories of comparison, the stories of jealousy, the stories of all that stuff that we suffer from. And the more we do that, we write this really beautiful autobiography. We write our own story. We live our own story. And the accumulative effect of that is a kind of peacefulness and well-being with having done something well, having done this dance well. There's a lot of grace in our tradition. This is what we all discovered when we went to Thailand. Kind of clumsy Westerners without much body awareness. And then just seeing the gracefulness of physical movement, the gracefulness of the heart that we're trying to cultivate, the gracefulness to accept admonishment, the gracefulness to wait and listen before jumping in, the gracefulness of being sensitive to someone's sickness and their need. All that is living a very, very beautiful life. So just going back to the piece about the dream with my mother, now that feeling was tremendously beautiful, very, very beautiful. What I saw right away, I want to keep that. I want to keep that feeling. But then I'm never going to be free of the story. I'll just probably have to do all that all over again. So I could see the beauty of this dream, and I saw that which arises ceases, not self. And that's the end of the story. So within the story, you have the end of the story. Without the beauty or the ugliness, the difficulty or whatever, within the beauty or the ugliness, the difficulty or whatever, there is always this chance to just know this is the arising and ceasing of conditions. So the ultimate truth is not a dismissal, or at least the way I look at it. It's not a dismissal of conventional reality. It's an understanding of how to use conventional truths, the conventions, like being a man. Being a man is a convention. Ultimately, there is maleness, certainly so in my karma. I have to understand maleness. I don't have to understand femaleness because I don't have that kind of physiology and those structures. So I have to understand maleness. But to say I'm a man as an identity, it's not true. There's maleness, or to say I'm old. People don't like me saying I'm old. Oh, no, you're not, they say. To say I'm old, or I'm young, or you're as old as you think. These are the conventions. But certainly this body doesn't feel 34. It feels 66, 64. It feels the way it feels. But that's part of the narrative I live. So part of the narrative we live is to take vitamins. We do yoga, all these delightful things. We take a bath, all the serious things of our narrative. We have to. Part of our story is to care for the body. You could say it's just the five heaps, but it likes sarfus. It likes balm on its chapped feet. It likes food. It likes to be cared for with kindness, not indulged in. That's part of the narrative. And then our emotional world, emotions that we feel, powerful energies, and to understand our emotional world in a way of not identification, And yet participation, isn't it? I have to participate in my emotional life. I can't just look at it as some kind of abstract, in some kind of abstract Buddhist way. Oh, these are just feelings. I have to engage with life. I have to speak with people. I have to know my heart. I have to be with that. How can I be with that in a way which is kind and gentle? So if I experience a lot of fear or experience boredom or annoyance, all these delightful things that we go through, I need to somehow relate to that, just as I relate to pain in the body, to a backache. I need to do it with kindness. So the capacity to live this story in a very kind way, in a very caring way. If you think about the way we do things as samanas, Venerable Kasapo was showing me how to do some knots, which I wanted to know. And he's so caring. He comes, he's got it all set up, he shows me and I try that. We develop this beautiful kind of caring ethos. And for a group of men practicing together, that's pretty rare. If you think about how men quite often compliment each other, oh, you fat slob. That's a compliment. Oh, yeah, yeah. This in-your-face insult is a compliment. Is that true in America too? I've seen it in Canada. But what I've noticed in this community is the sincerity here. Lovely. Someone sincerely saying thank you, as opposed to a worldly, cynical attitude. Oh, you just die anyway. These are lovely things, and so our life, I think the kind of a story that we can live, is a story which is imbued with caring. Caring for our requisites, caring for kutis, caring for our acharyas, caring for the sick, and then caring for our own hearts. So when you care for something, like when you have pain or something in your body, and you care for it, you begin to understand it. You can indulge in it if you're hypochondriacal, or you can just ignore it. The body doesn't like that. Same with the heart. You have to, first of all, care for the suffering that one experiences, for the perceived limitations of one's practice, for the history, the emotional history we bring into this life. You have to care for that. When I care for something, then I can understand it. If you think about it, if someone is talking to you and you've never met them before, you don't know who they are and they're trying to express something to you, you have to wait. You have to listen, don't you? If you just jump in and butt in and already have an answer of what they need to know, then you're not really caring. You're just reacting to that. So caring, listening, and actually listening to your heart, listening to the habits of mind, listening to the narratives that are going on, seeing these narratives that I'm hearing right now, these stories I'm hearing right now in my mind, what are they symptomatic of? Are they symptomatic of care, of compassion, of aspiration, or are they symptomatic of conceit, of self-disparagement, of whatever it is? So listening to one's own stories is a caring practice, but not just indulging in them. That's not a good story. I don't think I want to live that one. I don't want anyone to do my biography with that story. In learning to listen to one's own heart, that takes a kind of patience. First of all, it takes an attitude where I'm willing to care for something which is uncomfortable, unpleasant, difficult. And in that listening attitude, insight has a chance to arise. As I mentioned in a previous talk, watchfulness and availability, these two have to be in balance. Attention and receptivity, they have to be in balance. You have to pay attention. But I have to allow the moment to reveal itself, and then in that, there is a true understanding, and then wisdom naturally functions from that, doesn't it? It's like bird watching. Anyone do bird watching? Bird watching, when you've seen the difference between a crow and a vulture, you can see a crow like a long, long way, and you know it's a crow. It's not a vulture. Your eyes become so perceptive of just the slightest shape of the way the wings flap, the way they fly. But how does that come about? It comes about through watching, looking at your field guide, watching, looking, you begin to recognize, oh, that's a crow and that's a vulture. And you become attuned to that, very perceptive. So it's the same in understanding our own heart, our own suffering, our own liberation from suffering, is you have to have that sense of allowing it to present itself, allowing it to become conscious. What does it really feel like now? So if I'm afraid or I'm ticked off at someone, what does it really feel like to be ticked off? What is that? And then in that you begin to recognize that it's bodily formations, it's energetic formations, the narratives and stories that spin off from that, and you become adept at being ticked off. But you don't follow that story, you have to let it go. But through caring rather than judgment, through understanding rather than through repression, through wisdom rather than ignorance. I remember once in England, I was watching outside my window. I was watching some blackbirds. Now, blackbirds are very common in England, a dime a dozen. So normally you say, oh, it's just a blackbird. I was watching and watching, nothing special, nothing special. And all of a sudden I saw another male come into the territory of this blackbird, and they started to go at it. They were really going at it, flying up and clashing and flying up. And finally, one of these blackbirds pinned the other one down, had his beak at the other guy's throat. So I thought, he's going to go for it. He's going for the jugular. And he lets him go. And then 2 minutes later, they're fighting again. Now, what's that got to do with Buddhism? Well, that's the way inside works, isn't it? It's like you don't understand something about your own conditioning. You're upset about something or whatever. You have to just watch something rather than try to fix it or rather than trying to get something else. Just give it time to reveal itself. Live morally, practice restraint, live within the boundaries of this life, and then really care for this thing. What is it like? And then you see, oh, that's what I'm grasping, or that's the craving, or that's why I'm reacting to that person. Sometimes in a monastery, we don't get along with each other. My goodness. Like Ajahn Chah would say, you know how we carry water in the monasteries in Thailand? We have a bucket of water on a pole, and then one monk has one end of the pole and the other monk the other end. Ajahn Chah would say, well, why do you always carry water with the monk you like? You should carry water with the monk you dislike. When we have interpersonal friction, when that goes on, it's an interesting one in Sangha life. You know, if you're going to live together, you're going to have to get along with this person. Otherwise, you can't go. You can't go anywhere unless you leave. So then that very person who triggered a sense of annoyance because they're too slow, or a person triggers a sense of intimidation because they're very competent, or whatever it is, that becomes the point. That person becomes the very trigger for you understanding something important about yourself. So it's not so much a problem as a kind of opportunity to see the very sense of intimidation if you're intimidated by someone. In monasteries I've been in, if you have a very competent carpenter or gardener, we had this gardener called Walter Stengel. He was in Buddhacums to Sussex. And Walter was very Germanic, archetypical worker. And he wanted everyone from the Sangha to help him plant a 100-tree apple orchard. I wasn't the work monk then, fortunately, but he got assigned a poet from Wales to help him in the garden. And this poet from Wales brought along a wheelbarrow without a wheel. And Volta went bananas. You feel a bit, oh, this guy's not competent, or why doesn't he work faster? And so the mind complains. So we can talk about that, but just to awaken, this is the complaining mind. That's the story being spun out right now. This guy doesn't do enough. Nyah, 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 nyah. Is that a story I want written down? Is that the story I want to live by? Or is there a better story? The easiest story is, this is a feeling. This feels this way. Or another story is, may he be free from suffering. Or may I be free from suffering. So we have a choice. To listen to the mind, to hear the stories of the mind, and then to begin to really craft your own story. This is a possibility. And then as the story becomes wholesome, not very exciting, pretty normal, then the whole need to be in a story begins to fall away. The whole need to be part of a narrative begins to fall away because the heart's very content. There's no need to judge others or feel judged. There's no need to be competitive. There's no need to be afraid because that's all fallen away. And then the story is still lived in a very beautiful way. But the responses are quick and not perpetuated. The responses that we have to life, we have to respond, we have to relate and so on. But the responses aren't perpetuated. You know how sometimes someone will say something in our face and we'll perpetuate that response for 2 days. Why did they say that to me? What did they mean? Why? The blah, blah. That's the story of habit. That's the story of aversion or whatever. But as we cultivate these really wholesome possibilities in our own heart, there's a beautiful confidence and clarity from that open heart where we don't perpetuate those responses. We feel things. They come and they go. We're left more with the silence of the mind. So my story with my mother, I could say it never happened, or I could say, well, that's just a perception, that's just a memory, it's true. Or I could say, that was a good chapter. I can say both, can't I? And both are true. It's the paradox that we live in. So thank you again for all your kindness and generosity and bon ami. And I shall definitely come back. I'll leave that for your reflection.